From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Anthony Horowitz returns to the show this week. He's one of my favorite mystery writers. He's written a ton of novels for adults and young readers, and he's written some excellent television, including every episode of Foyle's War, one of the best shows ever. He has a new TV series coming soon called Nine Bodies in a Mexican Morgue. He has written three great James Bond adventures and a couple of Sherlock Holmes books as well. Anthony Horowitz published Magpie Murders in 2016, which introduced the character of Susan Ryland. That book was adapted into a fine TV show. And Susan Ryland returned in Moonflower Murders, another novel and TV series, and also great. And now there's a third in the series. It's called Marble Hall Murders. Anthony Horowitz, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
It's lovely to be talking to you again, Gary.
After that introduction, I'm afraid we're out of time, but thanks for joining us.
You said so many nice things about me, I'm not surprised.
So I had to laugh when Susan Ryland, who's a very smart book editor, she expressed disdain for continuation novels like the ones some people have written about Sherlock Holmes or James Bond. Was she thinking of Anthony Horowitz?
I can't believe that would have been the case. That would have entered her mind for a moment. And I have to say that, speaking personally, I'm a big fan of continuation novels, and I love writing my own ones.
It was a little in-joke, I guess, on all of us.
There are lots of them in that book.
Well, you have that novel within a novel again happening in this. Is that really fun for you to write in a variety of styles?
It is enormous fun. It's also very, very challenging, because what I find myself with is two different time frames, and you could say two dimensions, because you've got the real world and now, and you've got the fictitious world of 1955, and they are connected in myriad different ways. And I have two sets of murders, two sets of suspects and clues and all the rest of it. And at the end of the book, somehow it's all got to come together and make sense. But, and this is the most important thing, I don't want to lose the audience on the way. It's got to be a clear, easy, fun read. And so that's the challenge. It's marrying those two almost opposites.
And also you have to, in this story, of course, I don't want to give anything away, but there's one of the people who is writing the novel is not as good a writer as some of the others. So you have to sort of find a way to convey that.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point you make. When I started writing the book, I thought to myself, this is a new young writer who has never had a successful book. And he has been chosen largely because of his name. He's the son of a very famous writer, and he's been chosen to write this book. And I don't think he will be that good at it. But at the same time, I cannot write, I don't know, 50, 60, 70,000 words if they're not well written. So what I think I've done is I have put in a few sentences here and there that jar, but just very slightly aren't quite my style, which aren't perfect. I even have Susan Ryland, the editor, you know, picking up some of these points and challenging him on them. But by and large, I think the book, his book, is well written. Of course, it's unfinished, but as you know, even Susan herself is surprised to find herself enjoying it.
You know, you once told me that you stopped writing the television series Midsummer Murders because it seemed to strain credulity that there could be so many murders in a small town. And so with that in mind, I wonder, why can't Susan Ryland, you know, just stay out of trouble? You know, most of us, we go our entire lives and we're only involved in just a few murders. But
there is no real answer to that question. I mean, I could sort of bumble around it a little bit. I mean, if Susan Ryland was, shall we say, a private detective or a police officer, I wouldn't have a problem because crime would find her. But because she isn't, and I really like the fact that she isn't, she's an editor, she has a real life of her own, you know, inevitably she is going to find herself again and again in the same sort of trouble. And it does begin, I suppose, to sort of challenge credibility, except I hope that readers will go along for the ride. I suppose the only defense I can offer you, Gary, is that this is the final book in the series. So you can imagine that her life from now on will be very easy, very pleasant, but unfortunately, it will not yield any more books.
Well, you say that, but I don't believe you. I'm sure she'll come back. I have no doubt. In fact, I think she and her, the detective who's pursuing her in a way in the book, are a wonderful team. I could see them doing some more adventures together.
Well, you know, we do have a third TV series coming up, so we'll see them again incarnated on the screen. And actually, you are right. I do have half an idea in the back of my head that does involve Susan Ryland, but it is very, very different from the first three books. Although it will still have a book within a book, it still changes a formula. And that actually, at the end of the day, is what the most important thing is. It's you can look at the sort of coincidence of these crimes happening. But if you look at the three books, Magpie, Moonflower, and now Marble Hall, I think you'd have to agree that at least I am varying the formula. It's not just same old, it's new ideas. This one, for example, the writer is still alive. He is working with him. And the whole book, to an extent, is about that relationship. Whereas with Alan Conway, who is no longer with us, I'm afraid, I miss Conleth Hill in the TV show. There was no relationship there. It was sort of, you know, he hated her and that was it. But things have moved on, even if it is in the same world.
I'm not implying in any way that I didn't enjoy thoroughly all three of these books, all of your books, so.
Take
no offense with my crazy question.
I never take offense.
Well, you know, you were mentioning how difficult it is because you have these two stories going with two sets of suspects. Do you have a method for keeping them all straight? Do you have like a bunch of index cards, or do you have a wall like a detective would have?
I don't do walls. I don't do index cards. I don't like that because I've always believed in the sort of the free flow of writing. That writing, it's sort of, you know, it's embracing the unexpected and the unpredicted and going where the story wants to go and letting the characters to a certain extent live their own lives. And if you start pinning things down, literally, you know, or sticking them down on the wall or drawing charts, whatever it is, to me that's like putting on a straitjacket. I don't really want it. But at the same time, though, I can't write the books without a lot of thought and a lot of sort of, you know, work before I write a single word of the book. So what I tend to do is I start with notebooks. I fill notebooks with page after page of questions and notes and little diagrams and doodles, drawings. If I find a photograph, I'll slip that in. And I have all, as it were, I have a list of what I call ingredients. I write on a page. These are the ingredients of the book, that this character will die in this way at this time, and these will be the clues, and this will be what happens next. But that isn't the same as a schematic. It's just simple. It's a collection of ideas, often quite random. And as I'm writing, I always make a note of everything I put down. So if I think up a clue for the first time and it wasn't planned, but it seems like a good idea, I need to make a note of it so that when I get to the end, I can see that everything has been dealt with and everything is in the book in the right order and in the right place.
Are you thinking when you're writing of doing it as a TV show? I mean, what comes first? This is going to be a novel. This is going to be a TV show. This is going to be a novel, then a TV show. How does that work?
I never usually write a novel thinking it'll be a TV show, although I always do try to write in a visual way. I think that the audience readers these days are incredibly visual. When I was young, a boy, you know, we had a world which was much more the written world. You know, in a British house back in the sort of 60s, 70s, you had a TV in one room, a television in one room with maybe just three channels. Now you've got 50 screens in a house and you know, 500 channels you can access over the internet. So we have become much, much more visual. So I'm always thinking of myself in visual terms, which lends itself to TV. But in terms of Marble Hall Murders, it's a different story. We had just finished shooting Moonflower Murders, and I had, put it all behind me and thought it was over. When Leslie Manville, our star, said she'd had such a great time filming it, why don't we do a third? And when somebody of her stature gives you that invitation and every green light goes on, in both the UK and America, PBS and Masterpiece immediately very excited about it, and BBC, etc., you can't say no. So I said, OK, fine, I'll adapt the novel. And then remember, there was no novel. So I had to very, very quickly go home. And I say quickly, it took me about between 5 and 6 or 7 months to write Marble Hall Murders as a novel. But even that was twice as fast as the one before it and about five times as fast as the first one, Magpie. But I wrote the novel, finished the novel, I think, on a Tuesday, and then on Wednesday started the TV adaptation. I have to tell you, it nearly killed me. I had a lot of work to do. It was so much work to do. And actually, I was late talking to you today because I'm still working on the scripts and still you've been very gracious and kind, but I have been absolutely lost in the final drafts which are in front of me now.
Well, it's not a Marble Hall Murders, Anthony Horowitz. It's not a tiny book. It's a substantial. I think it's twice as big as Trigger Mortis. Maybe I'm wrong.
Are you kidding? It arrived on my desk last week. The proof. You've got the soft cover there. I got the hardcover proof, which landed on my desk with a resounding thud just a few days ago. I could not believe how many words there were, how big it was. I mean, it is itself a sort of a lethal weapon. You could commit a murder with it. I think I'm not going to do. It's big because it's two books. That's the point. It's a book inside a book. So when you buy Marble Hall Murders, you are buying effectively two books, two murders, two solutions, and all the rest of it. But it did wear me out last year, especially because I had to adapt it so quickly. And I'm looking forward to doing my next book, which is going to be another Hawthorne, which is a comfortable sort of 80,000 words and just sort of fast in, fast out.
Well, when you're writing a book, do you just walk around like with ideas in your head and you have stories, the beginning, the middle, the end, they're all there and you just have to find the time to write them down? Or do you start as you start creating when you sit down to write?
It depends on the book. I mean, if it's a murder mystery, I start with a very simple circle, if you like, a little, the heart of it, the bullseye in the dartboard, which is, it is two people, A and B, and A murders B for C, which is the reason. And I look for that motive. That's what I really get started with. Why at the end of the day would somebody want to kill somebody else? Then you ask yourself, who are those people? Are they a journalist and a film star, let us say? And if so, why would the journalist want to murder the film star? And then you start thinking to yourself, well, there aren't that many reasons why people do kill each other. In fact, I can only really think of about three, because, fear is one and envy is another. I want something that person has. Or hatred of them, they've done something that I despise. And so you start thinking about those sort of, and as you start to think about those two people and the various variations on those motives, it all sort of begins to mushroom out. This journalist has got a wife and she's got all sorts of baggage, and she might have parents and friends and children and the person who lives next door. And they're all part of, so what it is, it's a sort of a, it's a controlled explosion, if you like, of ideas and characters and themes. And my job is, if you like, to corral them, to get them to work, to be enjoyable and to flow.
Is it easier to set a story in the era before now? Because, now you can't do anything without getting, somebody's got a photograph of it, there's a wreck, there's all DNA and all this stuff. Whereas, it seems like Agatha Christie had it easy because there was none of that stuff that she didn't have to worry about cell phones when she wrote her story.
Well, in some respects, I'm not sure it's easier. I wouldn't use that word, because actually, if you think about it, in this day and age, every single answer to anything you see or want to know is in the palm of your hand. Here it is, the most powerful computer, more powerful than anything Agatha Christie could have imagined, with all the answers on the world. Just press a button and you know everything.
Yeah,
I like what are called golden age murder mysteries set in the past, not because they're easier, but because they bring everything down to an intellectual. That you don't have forensics, you don't have science, you don't have computers, you don't have Google, you don't have a team of people helping the detective. And I like the fact that in my books, the detective and the reader have exactly the same information. When I was writing the show Midsummer Murders, I was always saying, don't put anybody in the show in white coats, because that takes it away from the public domain. It puts it into a specialist area. Susan Ryland is like you. She's like me. She's like any of my readers. And I think that's one of the joys of reading a murder mystery novel, is that sense of traveling side by side with the person who's going to solve the crime.
Oh, I love her. I think she's a great character. And I loved the television series. I'm looking forward to the next one. It's always great. Now, I have a question about in your novels, within the novels of the last three novels, The Magpie, The Mayflower, The Marble, there's secret messages in the inside novels. And I wonder, do you put secret messages in your novels?
Oh, yes, always. I like not like Alan Conway or Elliot Creasom, a new one, who both hide rather unpleasant secrets in their books. I love hiding what are called Easter eggs, little smiles. And I've done it in all the books I think I've ever written, all my children's books and everything. I have a sort of fantasy that one day somebody will sit down and actually, you know, search for all the little clues and surprises during the books. Of course, that's nonsense. You know, at the moment I die, that the books will all, you know, evaporate along with me. But nonetheless, it's a sort of a game with mortality, right? That I do it with. And you know, in the three books you mentioned, Magpie, Moonflower, and now Marble Hall, I always remember that Susan Ryland is looking at the work of a fictitious writer, whether it's Elliot Crace or Alan Conway, but she herself has been created by another writer, and that's me. So yes. She herself, without knowing it, is a piece of fiction. So why shouldn't bits of my life come into the stories? So in Moonflower Murders, for example, Crete, I go to Crete all the time. The places that I mention in that story are places I visit every summer, and some of my friends turn up from Greece in jobs in the hotel, or just mentioned, I think our Yanis Hordakis, the wicked cousin, is mentioned a couple of times in that story. He's my next door neighbor. And so these are little jokes and things that I just like to put in, but not like Alan Conway with malice, but just for a smile.
Do you think other writers put secret messages like the Beatles?
Oh, I'm sure they do. When you're sitting alone in a room for sort of 100 hours a week and there's nobody to talk to, and you know you've got another 1,000 or 10,000 words to write, and sort of, you know, a deadline ticking, you've got to keep yourself amused. And you know, I do it in two ways. One is by hiding things in it, and the other thing is by taking people who have crossed me in one way and using their names and giving them glorious deaths. but I'm sure other writers do this too.
Well, you're so busy writing. Do you ever read? Do you have a chance to read anybody?
Of course, I'm reading all the time. I never stop reading. This last year, since you ask, I discovered the Slow Horses book for the first time, Mick Herron. And I've been absolutely reading one after another after I've read all eight of those adventures. Now I'm reading his other work too. So that I'm late to the party, I know, but you know, that's part of the joy. I read a lot of 19th century literature. I have a big library downstairs, and I find that the great masters of literature, you know, Dickens, Trollope, Hardy, Austen, etc., and George Orwell, you know, I can return to their books over and over and over again and always find something new in them. I try to read a lot of non-fiction. At the moment, I'm reading Lawrence Rees, written a really wonderful book about that's a book that's on the go at the moment. It's about the rise of the Nazis and the parallels with modern politics, which is something, I guess it's one of the reasons why we read murder mystery. You just don't tell us what's happening in the real world. Hide in bed, pull the covers over. But that's a really, really interesting book, very insightful. So yeah, I'm always reading. And I do read a certain amount of crime as well, straightforward crime. I don't love reading crime, but mainly because there's always the fear that I'll come upon a really, really great idea and wish that I'd had it. I'll give you an example of that. In Ira Levin's book, I've just written the introduction to it in the new edition, a wonderful book, A Kiss Before Dying. There is one of my favorite clues in there to do with something that is borrowed. And that's all I'll say. But it's when I read it, it just creased me up. And I half stole it from Moonflower Murders, only half.
Well, I mean, I guess if you read a lot and you go way back, you could probably steal some things without anybody noticing it.
I think steal is not the wrong word. I think that sort of borrow or even purloin. But I think that, you know, that writers, well, you don't put a book out there to keep hold of, to protect your ideas. You put your ideas out there to share them. So why not?
It's a good way. It's a good way of looking at it. Well, you write for television, you write for the stage, you've written adult novels and young adult novels, and what came first for you?
In chronological order, the first books I wrote were children's books, and I was pretty much a child myself. I was published for the first time when I was 21 or 22 years old, and why I decided to write children's books is still a mystery to me. All I can remember is that it was raining and I was bored. And that was the beginning of a long journey, 10 books that weren't massively successful, although they are all curiously still in print. But then Alex Rider, Alex Rider happened in the year 2000, and that sort of, you know, sent my career in a completely unexpected direction, which I'm happy to say was upwards. And then from there, I began to explore other areas. I got involved in television writing, and I've always wanted to write for theatre. I love theatre. But the reason I'm now writing adult books and have more or less moved out of the young adult market is partly and largely a question of age. I'm now writing for an audience that is something like five decades, or if not more, younger than me. And that feels like too big a distance. It feels wrong somehow. It's time to move out of it and leave that field to people younger than myself.
Do you get fan mail from young readers who are still discovering your stuff?
Yeah, a certain amount, still less than I used to, I'll be honest. Mail was largely superseded by email anyway. And I get some, but as I say, I mean, the last kids book I wrote, it was last year, actually. I don't think I got any letters for that one.
No.
But they loved it. Everybody loved it. Why didn't they write?
Well, you and I are roughly the same age, even though you're much, much older than me. You were born in April, and I was born in June of the same year.
That makes you 2 months, a whole 2 months younger than me.
That's right.
And don't you look it.
I was wondering what kinds of television shows that you grew up with, because I know what I grew up with, and we didn't get very many British shows over here. We had The Avengers and The Prisoner.
I was going to say, that would have been the first on my list, was The Avengers. I absolutely adored The Avengers. The Saint would have been another one.
Mm.
I can still smell what's cooking in the kitchen whenever, you know, when I think of The Saint. We always used to watch it on a Sunday evening with high tea in the TV room, the one day when we were allowed to watch television while we ate. And I love, there were a lot of American shows that I liked. I'm thinking of Aaron Spelling. I don't know how many, if he was the producer that I most admired, but I shows like there was an amazing show called The Invaders. I don't know if that was I loved that show when I was young. And I always think it's ripe for a remake, although no one has done it. I mean, it's such a great, great premise, you know, an invasion and only one man knows that the world is being invaded by aliens who have, as I recall, one, a deformity in their hand. That's the only thing you... That's right, it's a little finger. We watched the same thing. And of course, there was The Fugitive, which was remade as a quite good film with Harrison Ford. But again, the original series was so exciting. Man in a Suitcase. These were the shows that I loved. They really were wonderful. I mean, don't get me wrong. Modern TV is wonderful too, and I still love the shows coming out of America.
One of my favorite television series of all time, and I've watched it through from beginning to end, not just once, you know, but like maybe four times, is Foyle's War. That show is so wonderful, so brilliant, such great characters. I love every episode, and I see a lot of actors in that show that then went on to wonderful careers.
It was one of the great joys of making that show. And I'm going to tell you a little story about the very, very first episode where I'm looking at a scene, the Rushes, the Dailies, and there's a character who is what you might call a B character, on the side of a story. And she's a young girl and she's walking home with her boyfriend who's pushing a bike up a hill. And the boyfriend might be called a C character because he's just a detachment to the B character. And I looked at that performance and this is his young guy. He must have been like 20, 21. And I said to my wife, who was a producer, I said, God, this actor is, he's unbelievable. I mean, you know, can we quickly go and write some more scenes for him? That was James McAvoy. I think probably his very, very first screen appearance. Rosamund Pike was in that same episode, incidentally. So
I remember the episode.
We did discover some major talent along the way.
Yes, you did. And I remember, I know exactly the episode that you're speaking of because, as I say, I've watched Foyle's War over and over again. But, you know, one of the fun things about it is, even though I've watched them before, it doesn't even matter how it resolves. That's not the point. It's just I just think it's so well done. I don't know how you did it. Did you do a lot of historical research when you were writing it?
First of all, Gary, thank you very much for it's 16 years of my life you're talking about, so I very much appreciate your comments and your kind words. The answer to your question is yes, I would read three or maybe four books for every single episode. There were two books by two historians called Angus Calder and Norman Longmate, who both wrote social histories of Britain during the war. That is to say, life on the home front. And these books were just jammed with stories. Every time I turned a page, I'd find another possible episode for this TV show. And what I loved about the show was that it pretended to be a murder mystery series, but actually it wasn't. And often you'd have to wait two or even three, you know, and commercial breaks before you got to the murder. I was my love of that show came about because it was about murder at a time when murder had no value. With 500 people dying every day in France, which is only 50 miles away across the Channel, who gave a damn about the Duchess in the library with a knife in her back? And that was Foyle's great problem. His, you know, that was what sort of, you know, motivated him, was his sense of wanting to get out away from murder into the war. But he couldn't. He was stuck as a detective. And it was a joy to write. And I think what I'm proudest of is the number of stories that we did find, or that I found in these books and the books that they led me to, that had never been told before. You know, little bits of history that I discovered. And so those were the stories. I think that the murders held up, and that, you know, that every episode. But if I'm going to be honest with you, my favorite episode in the whole season, the seasons that we did, was a one called The French Drop. And The French Drop, which is actually the name of a magic trick, has no crime in it. It is actually a crime-free episode, uh-huh. and yet it's the one I most enjoyed writing.
Do you ever miss those characters and think, you know, oh, you know, I could do another story? I know you said you wouldn't, but do you ever think about them?
I think about them a lot, and in fact, it is sort of an ambition of mine to watch the whole series again. You know, when maybe this year, maybe next. I've been saying it for a while now, but I'd like to sit down and watch every single episode again, just to sort of, you know, reevaluate it and to relive it. I'm enormously proud of it. You know, we had so many. One of the things that I often got was people who had elderly or invalid parents who got enormous pleasure and comfort out of watching the, you know, episodes, often in the last, you know, months, years of their life. And I thought that was a wonderful thing to have done. But listening to you talking about a show which, you know, hasn't been on the TV for a long time, although it probably is being screened somewhere in the world even as we're speaking, it never seems to go away. You know, I think to myself, wow, that's you know, I'm very proud of the of some of my writing, not all of it, but that has a very special place for me.
I have a DVD box set if you want to borrow it, Anthony Horowitz. So I'll lend it to you.
You're very kind, Gary. I think I have about a crate of them downstairs in the basement. but if they've all got, if they've rotted away, mice and mildew have got to them, I will give you a call.
I know that you're probably, you just mentioned you're in the middle of tying up the script of Marble Hall Murders miniseries, but you're probably halfway through a couple of other novels. What are you planning? What's coming?
Well, you mentioned already the Nine Bodies, which will be playing in the States next month, March. And I'm thinking about a sequel to that. It's gone down very well with MGM who commissioned it, and with everybody who's seen it. It's very different. You talked about earlier about Golden Age crime. This is the exact opposite. It's quite, you know, people who know my work, I think I hope they won't be unpleasantly surprised, but it's much edgier, darker, more violent than I normally write. But that was the idea that came to my head. And I would like to do a sequel to it. It's a little tricky when your entire cast is in the morgue, but we can we can find a way around that. And then I'm thinking about the next Hawthorne novel. I in fact had lunch with my publisher today, and we were talking about Hawthorne number 6. You know, these are the books in which I appear as a sidekick myself, and I have a plot for it and ideas for it, and we'll start writing it probably in a month's time or two. And what else? That I think is probably it, a TV show and a book sort of nudging up my consciousness. There are going to be 12 Hawthorne books in all, so some of those are sort of lining up.
Do you have 12? Do you have 12 stories that you're?
I've got about another three, I think, in my head moment. But the main thing I've got is the last book.
Ah,
you know, I'm interested in trying to discover why Hawthorne, this detective, is such a damaged and not entirely likable man. I have a belief that everybody on this planet has a reason for being how they are. I mean, it's easy enough to dismiss somebody as being stupid or unpleasant or or cruel or crazy, whatever you want to say. But I'm fascinated in what makes people the way they become. That's the story of life. You know, what were the lines that brought us together in this Zoom, you know, across the universe to suddenly find this moment together? And I find that endlessly sort of fascinating. And Hawthorne, something awful must have happened to him in a Yorkshire village called Reith when he was a child. What was it? And I think it'll take me 12 books to find out.
What about continuation novels? Have you thought of doing any more? I know you
don't want to do any more, I don't think. I mean, there is a possibility that I might, could be, have my arm twisted to do one more Sherlock Holmes, my arm twisted by myself, but only because I so loved writing The House of Silk and Moriarty and so loved the character. But I think that, you know, again, it's an age thing. You know, how many more years do I have to write? How many more books are there in me? Maybe it's best to stick to my own.
Well, whatever you do, I'm going to love it, and I hope you will come back and talk to me about it on From the Bookshelf.
It's a real pleasure talking to you, Gary. Thank you so much.
This week, we welcome Dr. Tess Gerritsen back to the show. She's the author of many, many, many books, bestsellers around the world. She's sold over 40 million books and has won awards, and yet she still finds time for this show. Her new book is called The Summer Guests, and it's a great one. Tess Gerritsen, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, great to be back.
I want to talk about your new book, and I have a million other questions about things, but let's start with The Summer Guests. It's a great, complicated novel, and it doesn't go in the direction that you think it's going to go. There's lots of surprises, and I know we don't want to give anything away because, you know, that would spoil it. But what do you think readers should know going in, if anything?
Well, they should know that it features a core group of people called the Martini Club. And it's based on something that happened in my own hometown here in Maine, which has a lot of CIA retirees here. There is a history of CIA working in Maine, and that is like the general background of the story. But the heart of the story is about a summer family that comes here every summer. And this year, a teenage girl from their family goes missing. And my Martini Club spies and the local cop band together to find her.
So this is the second novel that features this crew. And I want to know, how does it work? So you think, I know I can do a series about these people. Or do you start writing a book and you go, oh, these people could be in a series? Which comes first?
What comes first was, The Spy Coast was never meant to be a series. It was just one of these stories I thought I would write about retired spies. But, you know, as often happens, when you create characters that feel very close to you, you don't want to let them go. By the end of that first book, I did not want to let these people go. I wanted to hang out with them and drink martinis. So I said, well, what's next on your agenda? What is your next adventure? And that's how the second book came about.
So when you have a story and you've written so many and started with romances and all those, do you know everything going in? Okay, I know how it ends and I know where I'm going and I have an outline. Or do you start writing and see what happens?
I very much start writing and see what happens. I'm trying to think back to what I did know when I started this story. I just knew that a girl would go missing. I also knew that when they drag the lake looking for her body, they don't find her, but they find a bunch of bones from a woman who probably died decades earlier. And that was as far as I knew. I knew that there was some connection between these two. And I also knew where the conflicts were layered in. I mean, that's when I start, I'm always looking for what is the major conflict in this story. And one of the conflicts in this story is the summer people, who are the rich, wealthy people who come in to Maine every summer and stay in their fancy houses, and the people who live here. So that us versus them, rich versus, you know, the haves versus the have-nots. And also there's a conflict between former spies and the local cop, who is much younger. So there's that other conflict of youth versus experience.
When your characters enter a scene, I mean, I'm speaking of it as like it's a movie, but it's a cinematic kind of style you have. When your characters enter a scene, they don't seem like walk-ons. They seem to have an inner life. And I wonder, you know, with all of your characters, and some of them are major and some less so, Do you write a little biography of them, how, especially the ones that are going to carry over from book to book? Do you have a backstory that's you can call?
No. A backstory. I wish I did, because it would make the writing easier. You know, it's funny. They walk onto the page and they start talking and they reveal themselves somehow. Often I can hear their voices in my head, and that in alone, I mean, if you can hear the voice of a character, your backstory is 50% there, because so much of a personality is conveyed through voice, male or female, age or young, educational background, what kind of a vocabulary they use. When they start talking to you, you can figure out who they are. And that's really what happened with this book and all my books. It is what they say that defines their character, for me anyway.
Do you do a lot of rewriting? And do you think, you know what, if they had said this back in chapter two, it would make more sense? Things like that.
Oh, absolutely. I don't really know my characters until I finish the first draft. I get all the way to the end, I think, now I understand why she is the way she is. I'll go back and fill in that detail. A lot of my second, third, fourth, and sixth drafts are about going back and filling in the emotional, the coloring of these people that I did not know about when I first started the story.
Do you write on a computer, on a pad of paper, on a typewriter? What's your thing?
I'm such an old dog. You can't teach me new tricks. I write my first drafts with pen and paper.
Wow.
My second drafts, I will type in, because I'm a very fast typist. But I always return to paper. I'll print it out and then I'll sit down and I'll work on that paper again. It's funny. If I sit in front of a computer screen, I often get writer's block. It's because when you have something on your screen, you want to be perfect. And the editor in your head turns on. Mm. And I want that editor talking to me while I'm writing my first draft.
That's very interesting. So writing it on paper is easier.
Yeah, because your editor is turned off. You're still composing. You're still using the creative side of you. You don't feel like you have to correct anything, because it's not as clear to you where the mistakes are as they are on the screen. I'm also blessed with really terrible handwriting. Maybe it goes back to my medical background.
That's right,
but
a doctor.
It's hard to see the flaws when it's handwritten on a page.
Well, I want to picture it now. Do you sit at a desk and write, or do you lie on the couch and write, or are you outside? Where do you do your writing?
Oh, it's always at my desk in my home office. I can write elsewhere, but I find that so much of writing is just process, is getting accustomed to a certain process, a certain place, and so that's my place.
So when you are, this sort of a layering of your story, how do you keep track of where everybody is? Do you have a wall? Do you have little cards? What?
No, I don't. I'm just there, just writing. And oftentimes I'll realize that I need to go back and fix a detail that I didn't layer in this particular clue. But it doesn't happen until the very end of the first draft, when I can see the shape of the story. I can see where everybody's motives are. And then a lot of rewriting, I will go through six or seven drafts. And I will go through those not just to get the plot to hang together, but sometimes I will realize, there's a scene that is missing here in this part of the story. I need to go back and put a point of view scene there. The very last chapter I wrote in my book was the prologue. And the kind of sets off the action, but I started off the story feeling like it was going to be a very quiet beginning, a perfect summer day in Maine, and realized that was not enough. I needed to go back in time a number of decades for you to understand the story.
Yes, a mysterious event sort of takes place 50 years in the past or so, right? Beginning of the book. Well, I wanted to ask you about this. So the book does. I'm not going to say slow, because that's sounds negative, but it has a peaceful kind of gradual start, and then as you get toward the final episode, it's faster. I mean, I'm reading it a lot faster for sure, and so I wonder, are you writing faster when you get to the end?
It feels like the book is easier to write towards the end, because all of a sudden the events start piling on top of each other. The first part of the book, I think, is the hardest part, because you are establishing people's relationships. And a large part of the beginning of this story is about the relationships within this one family, this very wealthy family, and you know, how they relate to each other, what their past is, and secrets. I mean, it's like, when are these secrets going to come out? When are you going to find out why they're doing the things they do? And that's told by the point of view of a newcomer to the family, which is helpful because she's figuring things out at the same time the reader is. So yeah, the beginning may feel slow because I'm trying to set the scene for you and give you an idea of who these people are.
Yeah, not slow in any pejorative way, but just gradual.
Yeah.
And of course we were reading it a lot faster. Do you ever, when you're writing, do you think of me, your reader, and you think what speed is he going to read this, or are you just into the novel? You don't think
I'm
of this.
Thinking of you, the reader. But when I write, I'm thinking of me, the reader. Yeah, I mean, it's always like, what book would appeal to me? So things that I don't like to see on a page, I will try not to put on a page. For instance, you know, I'm not that interested in technology, really. It's not, there's no motion to it. I'm not interested in guns. I don't really care about, you know, what kind of bullet went into that particular gun. So I will not spend a lot of time on that. I am more interested in what does character A say to character B that pisses off character B. it's really the micro tensions and the emotions that draw me into a story.
I noticed that there's not, although, you know, it's set in the present day and so people have cell phones and stuff like that, but there's not a whole lot of popular culture kind of references in your story.
Not this one. You know, there's something about living in Maine that feels almost last century. I mean, even now there's a slowness, a nice, quiet, peaceful feeling in the summertime when people, and that's why people come here again and again every summer, to feel like they can step back and take a breath. And I wanted that to be reflected in the story.
We're talking with Tess Gerritsen, and her new book is called The Summer Guests. It's really a great one. The last time we spoke, you were here with Gary Braver and you had collaborated on a book. How is it different when you're collaborating than when you're writing on your own? I mean, obviously there's an obvious difference. You're writing on your own instead of collaborating, but talk a little bit about that if you can.
Collaboration takes twice as long. I think because you're always checking with the other person and trying to see, does this work for you? That doesn't work for me. How do we fix this? So there's a lot more, collaboration just means you have to agree on stuff. And that takes twice as long as me just taking my pen and scratching out a paragraph and saying, no, I'm taking this out. The other thing is, for us who are novelists, you know, we're control freaks. we write alone because we like to be in control of our story. And it's easier for me to be, you know, to be total the master of my universe on paper.
Dr. Gerritsen, the reason I asked you on the show today is because I have this pain right over here. So you were, you're not a practicing physician right now.
No, I've been for almost 40 years.
But you were, you know, a lot of people who are artists like you, you know, they find something to do, you know, to support them as they establish themselves as an artist, you know, like working at a restaurant or something. But you were an MD. But, I mean, did you always know you were a novelist and that you were working as a doctor, or did you discover that you were a writer later?
I always knew I was a writer. I knew when I was 7 years old. And, you know, that's a really, it seems like it's a very common age for people to self-identify, storytellers. But my father advised me that it was not a way to make a living. So I went to medical school, but I always knew that writing would be part of my life, maybe as a hobby. And it was after I'd sold my third book that I realized, you know, I can do this. I can make this into a career.
And did you, do you miss medicine, or you were happy to say goodbye?
I am so happy being a writer that it makes no sense to me to ever leave that. And honestly, whenever I have anxiety dreams, you know how we all have anxiety dreams?
Yes.
Anxiety dreams are all about medicine.
Yeah. Well,
so I'm glad I'm not there anymore.
I was a middle school teacher for like 30 years, and I haven't been one for quite a few years, but I still have, when I dream, my dreams are all, I can't find my classroom, I don't know where the kids are, and so.
Well, yeah, it's so funny because I still have dreams about not having studied for a French lesson, and I never took French.
So. Well, then no wonder you didn't study for it. but of course, becoming a doctor, that was, you know, that's intensive amount of years in school.
It is. But in the end, you know, we all get to a point in our lives where everything that came before us is of value. And even though it was, 11 years of my life studying to be a doctor, I use that. I think I use that every day in my writing. And the other thing I use, which I actually find more valuable as a writer, is that I was an undergraduate anthropology student. Mm. There's something about anthropology that particularly, well, you know, it prepares you for diving into other worlds, looking at people as tribes, looking at people as different cultures. And that comes into your storytelling.
Well, tell me a little bit more about your origin story as a writer. When you were 7, what kind of stuff did you think about writing when you were 7?
I wrote the kinds of books I was reading. Nancy Drew, you know.
Mysteries. Yeah, Nancy Drew, mysteries, right?
Yeah, I loved mysteries, always have. And that's another thing that seems to be universal among American female mystery writers, is that a lot of us grew up on Nancy Drew. She was a role model for us. She was, an independent, smart. She didn't need a man to save her. And for some reason, her father just let her loose at 18 to go solve mysteries. So that was one big reason I think I went into writing. I wanted to write Nancy Drew stories. And I realized then that I always liked mysteries, or something about a mystery that intrigued me. So that was probably my big thing. The other thing is that I was always interested in police work, in crime, and that seems to work its way into every one of my books.
When you're talking about your writing 7 drafts of a book, who reads the drafts other than you? Do you have an editor? Do your husband read it? No, nobody reads it but you?
Okay. Nobody reads my drafts because they're horrible. Nobody gets to read my drafts until I feel like it's ready to mail into my editor. And then my husband reads my first draft, and he's very good at picking up typos or you know, errors in logic. And then after that, it goes off to my agent and editor simultaneously. Mm.
Yeah. So you're all alone in there it's like being a painter. You're doing several layers on your canvas. Is that how you would think of it?
Yeah. You have to trust yourself that your judgment, on your story is okay. It takes, I think, a while to get to that point where you are confident enough to know, hey, this one worked. And the other thing that you have to learn is knowing when things don't work, when something feels wrong to you. And that's where writer's block really comes in, I think, or plot block for me, when you've made your characters do something that you know they would not do. You have to figure out how to make everything fit who these people are.
When your characters appear on screen, for instance, Rosalie and Isles, the characters that you created that became a television series, and a great one that I enjoyed watching, when you see them on screen, do you think, oh, no, that's not them?
Well, in that case, it was very true. Because, you know, when I wrote Rosalie and Isles, I was writing about ordinary looking young women. Yeah. I thought of Jane Rosalie as being this scrappy, kind of a messy haired, badly dressed, a street cop. And then what did I end up with? This gorgeous woman named Andre Harmon to play the role. So, but that's Hollywood. You learn to just say, yeah, that's Hollywood. Yeah, and you roll with it. It was such an inherent part of Jane Rosalie's personality that she never felt like she could measure up to the gorgeous woman in the room. And then when that part got taken away from her, I missed it. I mean, I think we all identify with an ordinary looking woman. It's harder to identify with someone who walks out and she's a goddess.
Even in the morning, she wakes up with her makeup on. maybe they do it better in England. I think a lot of the actors in English crime shows look more like actual people.
Absolutely. And I'm addicted to English crime shows. And I mean, that's, we just go through, you know, the whole season of Vera, the whole season of all these old, British shows. And I love the fact they look like people.
Well, you're two The two main women in your story that are continuing characters, one of them is older, right? She's like 60 something.
Yes. Yeah. And that was the fun of writing this new series is that they're closer to my age. Mm-hmm. They're in their 60s and their 70s. And I want them to look that way. I don't want them to bring some glamour puss out to play Maggie Bird. Maggie Bird is a chicken farmer. But what's great about her is that even though she's gray haired and she's in her 60s, when she puts on a sexy gown, she's back being a spy again. And it's fun to see that transformation of back into what their active lives were. One of the themes of the whole series is that you're never too old to have an adventure. You're never too old to solve a problem that nobody else can solve. And I want to explore how those of us who are older, we still have a lot of, you know, we have our wits about us. We can fix things that maybe younger people can't.
You may be too old to climb a tree. I got that message from
yes. Okay. That's well, or if we do, something bad is going to happen. But we can still outthink these young folks sometimes.
You know, you and I share the same birthday. I was born on June 12th, and so were you. Am I right?
Well, happy Gemini Day to you.
We're and that's just one of the many ways that we're exactly alike, Dr. Tess Gerritsen. I wanted to ask you about, so you mentioned Nancy Drew, but in your book, you evoke a Raymond Chandler phrase from the title of one of his novels. And I wonder, was that intentional or has it just happened?
No, not really. It's I have it. I wasn't intentionally using that.
What mystery writers have you become fans of? Do you still read other people? Are you still busy writing 75 books? Do you read other people?
You know, it is hard to find time to read, and that is a downside of being like overwhelmed with projects. But I get a lot of free books, yeah. Just like you do. And that's one of the fun things about being in this industry. Absolutely. Is that. Yeah. A lot of free books. So I read a lot of, you know, my good friend Lisa Gardner, she's fantastic. Lisa Unger, I like her books as well. Lisa Scottolini, I'm going
has
down
to be Lisa's list. Yeah.
And Joe Finder has a fantastic book out, a spy novel called The Oligarch's Daughter. I love him too. So I think the thing these all have in common is they really do deep dives in character. They really look at, you know, things that move people through their emotions and maybe spend a lot less time on hardware, which, again, as I mentioned, I'm not interested in.
Are there works of literature that you fall back on, or are there works, the converse would be, are there works of literature you've never read that you think, oh, I should have read that?
You know, one day I am going to read from beginning to end the Bible. I have not done it.
I saw the movie.
Last time I got bogged down in Leviticus and I just said, I can't take anymore. Yeah. But just works of art, just works that are of cultural importance to all of us. Something like that. I mean, even though I'm agnostic, I feel like I need to know what goes into the Bible. Other works of literature. I should probably go back and read War and Peace again one of these days.
So you've read it though.
Yes, I have. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Years ago. And trying to think what else. I love Greek mythology. So, you know, some of my favorite things have to do with the Trojan War. I should go back and read those again as well.
We're chatting with Tess Gerritsen. Her new book is called The Summer Guests. Do you do a lot of research when you're writing a book?
Yeah, it's very specific research though. For instance, when I was writing The Summer Guest, I did quite a bit of research on the MK Ultra, which is the CIA operation, which is referenced in the story. It has a part in the story. And right now I seem to be doing a lot of research into Russian assassins. So, I don't know. It's funny. I mean, I normally would not be reading much about assassins, but that is a topic for the next story.
Yeah, it's a preview of your next thing. Well, do you have like 40 stories that are rattling around in your head and you just have to find the time to write them? Or
They come up one at a time, I think. I think I finish a story and then something occurs to me, and that and then I go full bore into that particular story. So I don't have, I'm not 10 books ahead of myself. And I have what I call an ideas folder. It's a physical manila folder with things I've torn out of magazines or newspapers. I think we're all avid readers, all of us, and particularly I love magazines and newspapers because you'll see something and you'll get an idea. You'll say, this is going to be a great story. I don't know what to do with it, but I'm going to store it away. And the example I always have is I wrote a book called Ice Cold, and that was based on a tear sheet that I took out of the New York Times, I think. And that was in that folder for maybe 15 years before I knew what to do with it. And it became the book Ice Cold.
Do you write, do you have like a schedule? Oh, I have to go to work at 8:30 in the morning and I must write until 4 o'clock or what?
Anything like that? It's just, okay, I'm going to write 4 pages today. And whatever time I do that, that's great. Or sometimes if I'm really, really excited about a section that I'm working on, I will spend all day at my desk and even, you know, get back there after dinner. But it's very episodic. It's not really a factory. It's more, what do I feel like? What story do I feel, part of the story do I feel like writing today?
Well, other than doing a book tour like this and talking to people like me, what other distractions keep you from your craft?
Well, I have another project that, in fact, I just returned it today. It's I'm working on a television pilot for NBC Universal. It is a TV show that's called Vacation Land, and it's about an Asian woman detective from California that is so disgusted with bad things that happen in LAPD that she pulls up roots and moves to Maine and ends up in a little town just as the local cop has been eaten by a bear. He wasn't killed by the bear. It turns out he was murdered. And so she ends up having to solve crimes in small town Maine, being the only Asian woman in town. So you can see there's a little autobiographical bit on this TV show. But NBC really loved the idea.
And have they cast you in the lead? Will you be playing the part?
Maybe I can play your mother.
Oh, well, that sounds great. So what phase of development will we, is it going to be on in September or what?
They commissioned the script and I just finished the first draft of the pilot episode.
Cool.
Yeah. So I have no idea, you know, there are so many layers to how things get developed in Hollywood. So that has a ways to go to get greenlit. And then, As you probably know, you know, Spy Coast is in development for a television series at Amazon. So we're waiting to see if that gets greenlit as well.
That's great. And have you written a pilot for that?
No. They have a couple of showrunners that wrote a fantastic pilot script. I've already read it. We're waiting to see if it goes on to the next stage.
That's fantastic. What about your next book? How far along are you and when will we see the next one?
The first draft is done. It's called The Shadow Friends, and it focuses more on the character Ingrid, who is part of the Martini Club. She was a spy. She's married to a former analyst, CIA analyst, who was never actually a spy, but they have this lovely, cozy marriage. And then one of her ex-lovers comes back into her life who was also from her spying days, and it complicates her life and also pulls her back into the business because they are tracking an assassin that they never found before.
Well, now that you're doing this Martini Club series, does that mean that other series are over, or will you maybe go back to other series and bring those characters back?
It's book by book.
You don't have a grand scheme.
No, I've never had a grand scheme. I mean, I never knew that Rizzoli and Isles was going to be a series. It just happened again with the characters.
Mm-hmm. And very profitable since it turned out to be a TV show and DVDs.
Yeah.
And people are still streaming it all over the place.
Yeah. And you can't plan these things out. I mean, careers are so, especially in the arts, they're so much out of your control. All you can do is tell the story the best way you can, fall in love with your characters and see what happens.
Well, you do that and you do it so well. Dr. Tess Gerritsen, her new book is called The Summer Guests. Such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for making some time for From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.